You're listening to Red Center, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Red Center. I'm Mike Seymour, and joined in the studio by Jason Wingrove. How are you, Jace?
I'm well, Mike. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
How are you now?
I'm much better than I was earlier. Well, when I say much better, I'm much more rested and kind of back in the zone. And looking forward to a month of really interesting Red Center podcasts coming to you, as we will be this month, almost hopefully every week. We're going to be running through a lot of stuff in the month of April, and not least of which is a special we're going to be running on Red Workflow as a request that was given to us by the Twitters and the Tubes. We thought we'd try and cover the guide to Pose. But how are you, Jace?
I'm very well, mate. Very well. I'm sort of come off a couple of other projects as well, so I'm nice and relaxed. Also, it's nice to be back together in a studio together rather than Skyping or not recording at all.
So to give you an idea what we're going to be up to, we're going to be providing you with, as always, news and some interviews, some Red Room stuff, but we're also going to be doing each week a breakdown on what's going on with Red Post Workflow. And Jace, this is, we'll get to the news in a second, but this is going to be, I think, kind of an interesting month to go through this stuff, because I know a lot of people are interested in it. But I just want to kind of flag that, how I was thinking of, if it's all right with you, breaking up the 4 weeks.
Sure.
So if we assume for a second that we're going to get 4 weeks out in April, I thought we'd start week one with some basic concepts discussion. In week two, we'd get into sort of what I call Red products, otherwise things that come from Red, such as, Red Rushes and of course, things like Red Alert. And then in week three, I thought we may as well just break it into online and offline. Start with offline, discuss Final Cut and Avid, and just the definitive solutions for how to deal with those things, even though I know you can, finish in Final Cut and in Avid. And then in week four, we'll discuss finishing and online, which means everything from SDK R3D support to DI grading to other boxes that are natively reading R3D. And, of course, along the way, we'll drop in news that's coming out of NAB and stuff that's coming from the show. Well, not really the show floor, is it? It's like the Rio show, as it were.
Yes, the Red User show, I suppose, is probably going to be the most interest to everybody.
So let's switch now to the news, and we'll discuss that stuff, and then we'll come back and pick up that discussion.
And now, the Red Center News.
And Jace, do you want to lead off with what's happening news-wise around the Red traps?
Well, first news is, Mike, it's our first anniversary.
Oh, wow. It's
happy
been a
anniversary.
Year. Oh, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
It doesn't mean much to... well, there's a lot of podcasts that have done a lot longer than us and, put a lot more into it. And you guys have obviously been podcasting for forever. But for me, this is my first new little podcast. So, it means a lot.
Well, we've had about, this is our 30th show in
which
in
doesn't
a year.
Seem like much either, really.
No, it's good. We wanted it to go out every 2 weeks, and 30 is definitely more than once every 2 weeks, so
yes,
that's good.
We've had some busy months and some slow months.
Hey,
yes.
Well, that's great. And in terms of Red stuff, I already hinted at the event in Vegas, but do you want to explain to everyone what that is?
Yeah, well, obviously Red had announced a while back that they weren't going to attend NAB, which obviously was a bit of a killer because everyone was expecting to be lined up at the door with money in hand, ready to sprint to the Red booth like last year.
That was fun.
but at the last minute, obviously Red have announced they will be displaying prototypes of Scarlet and Epic along with their Red Pro lenses at the Red User Party at the Rio Hotel on April the 22nd. Now, whereabouts does that sit in the whole NAB calendar, do you know, Mike? Is it like at the end of the beginning?
It used to be that Vegas had NAB running from Monday to Thursday, where Thursday was a half day. And so people would tend to deal with Thursdays a bit like the day that you got out of Dodge. And also it was the day that if you were an equipment manufacturer, you'd go and look at all the other equipment manufacturers. That was the way it was for years and years and years. Over the last 2 or 3 years, it's kind of crept into the weekend. So now you'll find there are events on the Saturday and Sunday, but the trade show still starts. But what that means is that people often come into Vegas and are normally even leaving by Wednesday night or definitely leaving Thursday morning. So this would be the end of what someone would reasonably consider to be a trip to Vegas if you're going for, say, an NAB full-on event. But I know people just go to NAB for like a couple of days.
Because you were doing stuff at the beginning, I think, last time. You were rocked up earlier in the weekend. There was stuff going on.
Yes, so this year PhD has a big party for PhD members, and it's actually a huge party.
Excellent. I unknowingly plugged us. Plugged you.
You did. It's true. Yes. No, we have joined with partners, some really cool senior post partners such as SohoNet, DaVinci, and the Foundry, and we're throwing the mother of all parties, throwing caution to the wind and ignoring the global financial meltdown and going doing it old school. But that's for FX PhD members, which there's so it's not unfortunately an open invitation. And that's all happening on the Monday night. On the Tuesday night, I think, is something else is on. And then on the Wednesday, there is the... Because I thought the Red user event was on the Wednesday, but there's a Red party as well, right?
I'm not sure about the Red party.
Because I think the Red party is on the Tuesday night.
It's
the Red party that they're actually showing the Scarlet and Epic at. And I think that's at the Rio, I think. But it could be... Have I got that? Have I got my wires?
Well, this is straight off off Red user saying basically.
Well, then they probably combined them because the Red user event is on the Wednesday night for sure. I know because I was going to be talking at that and I'm now not. So maybe that's what's happened. Maybe the Red party has combined with the Red user group. But definitely the Red user group is on the Wednesday night.
Could be wrong. Rio Hotel, the Red user party, Rio Hotel, Wednesday, April 22nd. So there will be some. There'll be a lot of vendors there as well, displaying in the Amazon ballroom all day long, and some rumored special guests, whatever that means. and there also will be they'll have a projector there. Now, I think initially they said they're going to have a 2K Christie projector there. Maybe it's been upped to 4K because I think there was talk of 4K projection going on because Red had done a bit of a call out asking for footage. So it's still not too late. If you've got some footage, particularly stuff with international flavour, amazing footage that hasn't been seen before, not just, you know.
And should point out that that footage won't just be used at that event, because in fact, Ted is speaking at most of the... I'll name drop here and say I was actually talking to Ted during the week about this. He's giving talks from the other booth. So a lot of the other equipment manufacturers now have R3D support. They've invited Ted along to give a presentation. And those booths that are well set up for it, he'll be actually showing effectively the Red showreel at that. So, for example, let's say he's talking at the Adobe booth, which I think he is. He then will go along with the reel and show that material. I think he's also talking at, I think it could be DaVinci and certainly... there's probably seven, I think, booths that he's talking at over the Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yeah. So if you've got footage, this is an awesome way to get it out there. It's not going to be a major plugging thing, but it's just be fantastic to, you know, if you've done some amazing shots to get them out there.
And that's being put together by Plaster City. And so Plaster City are very good at handling footage. So if you've got R3D files,
they
rest assured
the
they're going to respectfully, they will look after them and transfer them properly and make sure they're adequately displayed.
Yep, sounds awesome. Okay, other news. Now, this is a big one for me, I think, Mike, if it sort of means what I think it means, that DaVinci have announced native R3D support. Now, does it mean if you go and buy the brand new DaVinci Resolve and throw the other one in the skip, or can you adapt, you know?
It's a Resolve thing, not a 2K thing, but yeah, the Resolve will now read the R3D files. There's an upgrade for existing ones, and the idea with the Resolve is its ability to read the raw R3D files through the SDK, and that ability to do that with the power built into a Resolve means that it can produce very fast performance and doesn't require you to have, for example, gone in ahead of time and transferred everything to, say, DPX or to TIFF sequences or something.
Okay. Now, I mean, this is, again, questions without notice, but what I'd love to know is if you already have a Resolve, is it just software updates or have you got, or is it, you know?
Yep, as I understand, it's an update. I don't know if there's any fee for the update. I think it may just come along as a natural part of the... if you're on like a contract with them.
Yeah.
But if you've got any doubts, I guess just ask the local DaVinci rep. But
we'll probably have to research it a bit, but it'd be lovely if you can just turn up with your drive of R3Ds and an EDL.
Yeah, basically the situation is now that you've got quite a number of companies like Baselite, DaVinci, obviously Scratch, and a number of others that are all... and I think it's safe to say, and we'll get into this later when we discuss post-workflow, actually grading Red footage is now kind of one of the easiest parts of the puzzle. And in fact, grading 4K is not that much of a problem. I will argue you won't want to, but so the grading side of things is now probably one of the most solved aspects of the pipeline.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is probably, I suppose, at least maybe for Australia, at least for our sort of environment here, DaVinci is quite embedded.
Oh, in Los Angeles, it's incredibly dominant.
Okay.
Because the guys at, starts with A, sorry, the Post Group, Ascent Media, thank you. Ascent Media in Los Angeles are very much DaVinci focused, and hundreds.
Because although base lights and all of that equipment is now starting to creep in, and they have
obviously
now... I think
base lights stronger in London.
Yeah.
And Pablo, for that matter.
It is starting to get some foothold here, but obviously DaVinci is, at least for my kind of workflow, that is like to be able to now have native R3D, that is just fantastic. That's, you know, the next piece would be Avid. Insert sound of crickets here.
Well, no. Avid's very far along in...
Yes.
No, really. We used an Avid workflow on Red Dwarf.
Yeah, well, we can get into that in coming weeks.
Very much going to cover that Avid workflow. There should be no reason not to... We literally said, don't pick the workflow based on anything other than what the editor prefers. And we editor preferred Avid, and that's what we did.
That's the way to do it. Awesome. Okay. Last couple of bits of news. New for those camera owners, particularly those guys flying, there's some new, and I guess this is obviously a worldwide thing, not just dominated by the FAA, but new lithium-ion regulations. Theoretically, if you're traveling with any lithium-ion battery over 100 watt-hours, it is now classified as a Class 9 dangerous good. So Redwick batteries are 140 watt-hour, so therefore they're into this category. So theoretically, if you've got any problems with your red bricks, you're shipping them back to Red, or you know, you've got an absolutely notified, there's special regulations about shipping it now, or if you're ordering new ones, if you're going to ship them to Red, you've got to let them know in advance and obey these new regulations, otherwise they'll just, you know, go straight in the bin outside Red. You've got to...
They won't even get to Red. They won't even get on the plane.
Yeah, that's right. So
call up FedEx and say, take these four Red, you know, cardboard satchel.
I believe you still have the ability to carry red bricks on a commercial flight. There will be some limitations, though. So theoretically, you go to safetravel.gov. Now, this has the new rules and regulations, and you can check out what you can do and what you can't do with red bricks. So, yeah, it's getting crazy.
Oh, it's really quite a big deal, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, lithium is not, you know, it's not like Play-Doh.
No, it's laptops exploding time.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's any cases of red batteries exploding, but that's by the by. It doesn't matter. There's so much lithium in them.
Yeah.
That, yes.
Scary stuff.
Somebody notices them, you'll be pulled aside. I don't even think you're actually... do you know what I'm saying? So I don't think you're correct about being able to carry them on its hand luggage.
Okay.
I think you'll find that is very much in violation of their regulations at the moment.
This is from if you're going to be traveling with the red bricks, this is off the red user or any lithium batteries. Please see safetravel.gov for rules and regulations. You do have the ability to carry on red bricks onto a commercial flight. Carry on. Not in hold, I guess, with limitations, of course, but it is highly recommended that you check out the links.
But I think there's a limit to how much travel. You can carry. I think you can because I understand it, like it's like one or two. Like you certainly can't carry, I'm almost 100% sure you can't carry on like four or five bricks.
Yeah, well, maybe you have to split them. Most people would never really just have two, they're going to have three or four, and so you're going to have a couple on the hold and a couple. Ooh.
So if you've had experiences with this or you've been pulled up at an airport or whatever, can you let us know? Send us an email.
Yeah.
At red@fxguide.com.
Now, okay, the next bunch of news. Obviously, there's been a lot of little announcers of, oh, my God, things are really, really changing in the red world from Jim. And there's not a lot to really go into other than the fact that it's been announced that will be changes. The other thing they have said, basically, is that there is will theoretically be no schedule impact, but it's all good. So if you can't really say what it is, it's a little hard.
I've got to say, I think there's been almost a negative reaction to the announcement that it's all changing again.
Yeah, and I think that obviously then there was subsequent reaction. There were subsequent postings after that saying, "Look, yes, things are changing, but there won't really be any." The main problem from people is that that they're worried that the schedule is going to go back again, and it's going to affect.
Well, there's no guarantee it won't go back, but for the time back,
people want the cameras. People would be probably quite happy to buy the first Scarlett, you know.
Well, obviously, yeah, it was. Damn. So, yeah, but anyway, it's still hoping for a late summer August rollout.
Yep.
And the theory is that they're not going to go up in price, or rather there's not going to be like a hit to the price performance. And it's only going to be, you know, better, cooler, more fun kind of stuff. Having said all of
which is all great.
I do think there was, I mean, just being blunt, I think there was a negative reaction to, for the love of God, will you guys just stop doing this? Because I think they jumped the shark or jumped the sofa when, you know, they had the whole big, huge Red announcement, it's all going to change. And then it came out like 4 weeks after that. No, it's all going to change again. And then now it's like, it's all changing again. And it's like, okay, you know what? Just, why don't you just work it out and get back to me when you know what you're doing?
It is true that this is an incredibly unchangeable environment when you look at things like the 5D and everything that, you know, probably will be announced within 5 minutes of us hitting stop on the record here. It's obviously they're trying to keep it one step. I mean, I can totally imagine if you're prototyping something, you're designing something, it's got to be, you're going to get halfway and go, oh my God, hang on, we can do this. It can be much better. And there has to be that point where you go, okay, is it worth the hold up? Are people going to thank us for, you know, doing this one new step? You know, are people going to thank us for this whole new rethink along the way? It's part of, you know, it's part of the whole open Red thing. We've talked about it before.
That's true, but I don't know how many times you can say to people, get really excited about, I'm not going to tell you what. Hey, Jace, get really excited about the fact that I'm going to do something completely different. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it's really, get excited.
Yeah, if someone emailed you shit like that every week,
you'd be like, you know what, I'm kind of over it. And the thing is, I'm not over Red. I'm just, I think it's just a fatigue, you know, because there's only so much that you can do with non-news.
Yeah.
And you go, well, what do you want me to do with that information? You know, like, okay, I was just keen to look at it before. I'm still keen to look at it.
I think the frustration is for a lot of people, like me, who don't own a Red One and don't really, I mostly rent them. And obviously stuff that costs 17, 18 grand, I'm probably not going to go and buy one. But now, faced with the possibility of being able to buy something that's, you know, full frame, you know, that's Super 35 or like a little Scarlet for $3,000 or $4,000. That's something I could definitely get excited about and want to buy and own. So I think there's a whole new customer base that is chomping at the bit. You know, Red Ones at $20,000 or whatever is a whole different, you know, whole sector of the market compared to the HVX 200 kind of mob who are clamoring for something that.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess my point is more like, that's all true, and I'm totally enthusiastic to get Scarlet and Epic. The thing is, I got a Red One now, and I'm making money with it. And
yeah.
I can only get so excited about vaporware. You know, like, I mean, I can get really excited that they're going to do something, but at the end of the day, I've been excited now. Now, I can't do much more until I actually see it.
I've gone through excited, and I've come out the other side.
And I'll say this, like, I think the problem is a small one. It's not a big problem. It's just that I think Red themselves, when they announce this, tend to announce it with quite a lot of almost hype, and that is just getting a bit like long in the tooth. It's you know, it's almost like,
sure,
because at a professional level it's like, okay, well, I get it, it's I'm sure it will be really, really cool, I'm totally there, I love it to death, I think that everyone involved that I know at Red are brilliant people, but I just can't sustain a level of enthusiasm about nothing. You know, I mean, I'm sure if you were holding the prototype, you'd be more enthusiastic.
Sure,
but I can get enthusiastic about them showing prototypes at NAB. I think that'll be really good.
Yep.
But I'm more enthusiastic about that than I am about just announcing that it's all going to change again, but we won't tell you how.
So, yeah.
Well, so what?
Yeah, that's going to help us all get past the hump in next week or so when we actually have pictures of people holding the prototypes, possibly even, you know, should be able to shoot some stuff with it, video people holding it. You know, in the field, sort of, you know, people actually physically holding this stuff is definitely going to get some people excited again until now, the next hang on a minute.
Have we not discussed Izzy the Lizard last time we were on there?
We haven't discussed Izzy the Lizard. He's
talking
fantastic.
About real footage for a second.
Now, I can't remember, is he a Komodo dragon? Whatever, I can't remember what
I think
he is.
He's just a jolly great
people. But he's bloody awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, so obviously there's a clip on Red User of Izzy the Lizard, a massive sort of, I'm sure he's Komodo dragon, something like that, but he's actually, I mean, there hasn't actually released any video clips. It's like a little moving flash file. Yeah, so Izzy's shot on a 2/3 inch Mysterium X sensor, basically a Scarlet with a 100mm Red Pro lens on it, and he looks gorgeous. Again, it's stuff like that just makes you think, ooh, it's alive.
Yeah, interesting. You shot at 5.6, isn't it? I think that's the sweet spot they're going to be going for on that.
Well, I think it's fantastic. Lack of depth of field for a 2/3-inch sensor. I mean, again, I'm always surprised sometimes by stuff that's shot on the smaller sensors. But, yeah, it looks gorgeous and sharp. And
I think when we spoke last, I'd seen Knowing, but you hadn't. But you've now seen Knowing?
Yeah, I've seen Knowing. I thought it was fantastic, actually. That was really, really good. I mean, I was really impressed that nowhere did I really sort of see any sort of horrible, you know, artifacts or noise, and because it was shot, as you discussed on the VFX show, and we've discussed a lot with Ryan Kunkelman, one of the DIT guys, that it was shot on really reasonably early builds.
Build 15.
So, yeah, I was expecting to see the odd blowout or the odd bit of, you know, video-ishness or, you know, lack of dynamic range, but totally impressed. Never once did I see anything but what looked like film to me. And I'm not sort of saying that from a whole fanboy point of view. I was just watching it casually as a filmmaker, and I thought it was impressive.
Well, you know what? I think it's really good. I think the visual effects are in it really good, and we discussed that in the VFX show. But I do agree with you. I think magnificent stuff. There's a couple of shots that I didn't think were graded the way I would personally like, especially when they were first getting the time capsule out at the school. Yeah. But I know from the guys at Animal that they had the R3Ds and they said they were great, and it is just an aesthetic grading decision, and, you know, who am I to say I know better than the director as to how he wants it to look?
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's testament to Simon Duggan, who really at that time was breaking new ground. There wasn't an awful lot of big feature DPs to talk to about, help, I'm shooting on Red, what can I do? He was sort of flying blind for a lot of it, and they were making up a lot of stuff as they went along, and it was, pretty impressive. So, yeah, if you haven't seen Knowing yet, just go see it for a film anyway. Definitely worth the seeing.
Yeah, totally. I think it was very much like Dark City. So I think it's a good film.
We're going to say that I haven't seen Dark City.
Sacrilege.
I have the DVD at home. I've never seen it. It's one of the few ones I have.
You really like it. It's right up your alley. You'd really, really like that film. Okay. It's totally something that I would recommend.
Yeah, look, you know, I should do. Shot here, shot by lots of people I know. So, yeah, I should one day. One of those films. I haven't quite got my...
I think Kimball Rendell was also second unit director on that as well.
Yep, he was. Yes, and I think Ross Emery was DP on second unit.
Did you ever see Kimball's film Cut with Kylie Minogue?
No.
Shot in Adelaide. Anyway, hey, going on, what's next on our news front?
Well, I guess the big news is it probably leads us into our first round of post-workflow stuff, is the fact that obviously you've wrapped on Red Dwarf.
We have. Now, as we record this, it's pre-Dwarf going to air in the UK, which goes to air at Easter. So I'm not this week going to discuss the post-workflow of what we did. I have all that for you and what we shot on and whether we were on, you know, Red Space and how we did it with, I don't know, everything from R3D Data Manager to everything. So I'm going to go through once it's gone to air, because then I can discuss it with more. And I just don't want to stumble across.
Yeah.
And also, I can then say, in this scene, X, we did this, which you might notice because of Y.
Okay.
What I will do, though, is say that the material that we shot for Dwarf, the way it worked is we did an arrangement with Doug Naylor Productions and, Grant Naylor Productions, with the director, Doug Naylor. And the way that it worked is that we worked on the project and we got access to using it for training. Now, it's actually because of the Red camera that I got involved with the project. I knew Doug from years gone by and I stayed with him, and he's good, great. He actually phoned me up, though, because he was asking for stuff on the Red camera, and people kept on saying, oh, well, I know who knows about the Red camera. Mike Seymour knows about that. So, well, I know Mike. I'll just bloody call him. So when we did this deal, I was like, well, I can work on it if we can use it for training and stuff, which is exactly what we did. So, in fact, we're actually launching right now the courses that we're running in the April term of FX PhD. And Jase, we actually have three or four that are relevant, I think, to our audience listening here, because we are combining, obviously, Red workflow with post workflow with VFX.
Right.
Okay. So I'm just going to give you a quick rundown on what they are. We, as always, in FX PhD, have a background fundamentals course, and this time that's going to be inside the production of FX Red Dwarf. I was the VFX supervisor and second unit director, so we have a lot of experience of what it was like to run that production. We're going to be discussing a lot of things, and that's more general and specifically Red stuff. There are specific courses that are Red-focused. One is called Red 206, Tales from Production Around the World. Now, this is not just Red Dwarf. We're also covering The Knowing and covering TVC production. But the idea here is we're going to look at real productions and what it takes to set up to do Red workflow for a feature, for episodic television, for commercials at different levels. This is from the point of view that if you were maybe not a hands-on camera person, but you wanted to say, well, what's it going to take to do this Red production? This will address those issues, the sort of things you think about to have on set, how much storage we're talking about, just what the approaches were that were done by The Knowing, done by Red Dwarf, done by TVC.
Now that's speaking to actually people who have actually did it, not actually did third it. Heart.
No, this is, yeah, we're really getting in there and getting our hands dirty. But also, awesome. It's got a level of abstraction from being an uber geek out, because we have another course called Red 102, which is the Comprehensive Guide to Red Workflow. Now, it's no accident that we're doing this podcast, which will give you like an audio kind of summary, but I'm also flagging that whereas we can only discuss so much in the 10 or 15 minutes we have in each episode of Red Center on post-workflow, we, of course, have 10 whole effectively classes on this over at FXPHD, which is in high-def video that you can see. And so we're going to go through in that course from camera overview on, you know, time code and stuff to a discussion of color space and LUTs and log and lin, and then right through the Red apps like Red Rushes, Redline, Avid, Final Cut, Scratch, Adobe with After Effects and Automatic Duck and stuff, Flame and Smoke. I wonder why we're talking about that. Baselight, DaVinci, and other high-end systems, and then a final one that covers miscellaneous stuff, everything from stuff we've missed in other ones, maybe like Pablo, right through to odd apps and bits and pieces that we find really, really interesting.
So this is out now.
This is starting this week,
yep,
at fxphd.com. And there's even other courses that are on, say, post-workflow in like Flame that was used on the post in Red Dwarf. There's actually hundreds of visual effects shots we did in a very short amount of time.
Very.
So if you're interested in seeing that footage, seeing what we looked like, obviously a lot of green screen. If you're shooting effects footage with the Red.
Seeing what you look like.
Seeing what it looks like.
Oh, what it looks like.
I said it looks. Did I just get that wrong? I'm sorry. And that's going to be all really good. And of course, if you want a more in-depth discussion than what you're going to get off Red Center, then that'll be the place to go in terms of getting a really deep understanding of workflow.
So if you sign up for that then now, then you get entry to the party of all parties that you were talking about before.
Yeah, it's a good party. I'm not going to see what the budget is, but it's like, bloody buy a Red camera for it. anyway, so that being said, cool. If it's cool with you, I might head into this week's discussion on workflow, which starts with the basic concepts. Have we got anything else in the news, or am I jumping off?
No, that's pretty much it. Yep, absolutely. Yep,
we'll do some gear discussion after this just to break it up. But
yep.
So, people,
so if you see me raise my hand, Mike,
I will stop.
That's to indicate my eyes glazing over.
I don't want to be a boring lecture, right? But by the same token, we do want to address a bunch of issues that people have raised, and there's a lot of discussion that comes up with what is the current state of the art for doing Red workflow. And the way I think to deal with this is you really need to understand a bunch of concepts first, that's what we're going to do this week, and then we'll get into the specifics. And if you put all 4 weeks together, you'll get a really pretty good understanding. If you obviously want to get really in depth and do it at a DIT level or at a camera person level, then I'd recommend the PhD courses because they're obviously far, far deeper. So, Jason, it basically breaks down like this. There is some stuff you need to worry about in terms of color space and how the camera works.
Isn't that all easy, though? What could possibly go wrong in color space?
And then there's the basic discussion of what it is that you're trying to do with the footage and where it's going. And that post-workflow really breaks down to the concept of whether or not I understand how the proxies work and whether or not I understand how I'm going to work with the material when I've got it back. So I'm going to work from the back forward because I think it makes more sense. And it really is, this is how you should do a project. You should really ask yourself, what is it I'm trying to do with this thing? Because quite frankly, if you're trying to make a commercial, TVC, standard def, do not for a second consider 4K workflow in post. I mean, it is absurd in the extreme. And honestly, this is like, this is not a problem of quality. This is a problem of absurdity. It's the fact that we're used to being in an environment where we say, well, I want the very best I can get. And what you mean really is the very best I can get inside sensible limits. What people don't get when they go to Red is the sensible limits. They just think, well, I should do all 4K. And I go, well, why? Why do you think you should do all 4K? That's, well, that's the highest quality. And I say, well, yeah, but no one's going to see it in anything even resembling 4K. HD is a quarter of 4K, and you're lucky if most people see you work in HD, and a lot of commercials and stuff get done at standard depth.
They're all, actually all, yeah, nearly all. No,
and
yeah,
so
anyway.
you would be... I'm not making this up. You would be literally the same as saying, here are two spots. I'm going to put them on two identical God monitors and play them to you. In one case, you can sit there and watch it, and it'll look identical to the other. But in one room, I'm going to ask you to take hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of $100 bills and burn them while you watch it. And in the other, I will just give you a small car.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, right? Like, it's not on the screen. This it's beside the screen, whether or not you end up with a bunch of burnt money or the ability to spend the money on something else considerably more interesting.
And
like
brain cells.
Having a life.
And time. And,
and
life,
time. And just
and
a whole lot
stress.
Of things. And we're not talking like, you know, well, yeah, but like, I really want it to be. We're talking the difference between saying, I can't get any actor to be in my TV commercial but Robert De Niro and or Meryl Streep, and just getting a normal actor. You know what I mean? Like, you don't actually seriously say, I can't do this with anything less than an Oscar Academy Award winning actor. So
right.
Why should you say that I should do everything at 4K res? I mean, it is so absurd as to be beyond the belief of man. Now, is that to say that the Red camera is absurd doing it 4K? No, not at all. Because you capture typically high res and then you post it at lower res. And that jump from high res to low res just gives you a whole bunch of image quality. So let's forget Red for a second, right? Let's put it out of our minds and just think about normal film. You go to the cinema, you do not see films in 4K. I mean, major Hollywood films now.
Yeah.
But you will quite often see films that might have had something scanned at 4K and then down-resed because of what's called Nyquist sampling theory and a whole lot of other things that basically say, if you film it higher res, it looks better. And, you know, any artifacts that you may or may not be quibbling over at 4K all go away at HD.
Yeah. Well, let's back up to that concept, I guess, that there is that definite thing to say it's better to work at a higher res than what you're going to finish with, not 4K, but, you know, it's better to work at a higher res and then downsample it to what you need.
And the good analogy, the real analogy, is in commercials. If you shot a commercial today on film, you would not suggest a full film finish with film editing and film splicing and stuff. And then at the very end, when you've got a finished commercial with optical dissolves, only then doing a transfer to SD to output your tape. You'd just be like, well, that's just stupid. That's just friggin' moronic. And yet, that is the equivalent of saying, I want to post everything at 4K and at the very end just to output a standard def master. And yet, if you did do that, if you did your whole commercial at film res, editing it on film with optical splices and all that kind of stuff, you would get really great image quality and your master would be magnificent and future-proof and all the things that... But it would just be slow, cumbersome, painful,
crazy.
And stupid. Yeah. And so I would say without fear of contradiction that that's exactly what the situation is. In fact, the number of people that believe that they can actually project 4K is just ridiculous. And even if you can project 4K, and quite frankly, that's a really small number of people, if you could project 4K and you were standing, I don't know, 35, 40 feet away from the screen, you'd have a hard time picking 2K projection over 4K projection. We're not mm-hmm. talking like, you know, IMAX versus standard def. I mean, we're talking like you need to have a very unique situation where you're going to basically be able to tell the difference. And
so you're talking about brand new, beautifully installed, fresh, you can smell the sawdust cinemas standing next to each other, and one's got, you know, state-of-the-art 2K projector and the other one's got a state-of-the-art 4K projector.
Unless
you
it's
walk
a big
from cinema to cinema and not really...
Yeah, unless it's a really big throw, like it's a decent throw. You do that like in a small, you know, theatre-etty kind of environment,
yeah.
Couldn't tell the difference.
Mm.
You'd be like, what am I looking at? That's the 2K, really?
Right.
It looks pretty good.
Okay.
And so...
So don't sort of pick at your local cinema if they find out they're slowly going digital and they're putting 2K projectors in.
Hell no. And you know what? I mean, the fact of the matter is that 1920 by 1080, like HD,
yep.
is a big jump up over standard def.
Yeah.
And that's totally valid.
Mm.
And so it makes a lot of sense to work at HD or 2K.
Yeah,
2K is film standard, HD is TV standard. Totally makes sense. You want to capture higher res than that for a bunch of reasons. Like you want to blow shots up. You want to have nice image quality. But you know what? We also shoot the Red cameras at 2K when we're shooting off speed, and nobody says, "Oh my God, it's ghastly. You can't even use it unless you know, down res it." So that's a big
yeah, absolutely. Apart from the image crop, it's not. Yeah, there's no problems.
Okay, so then Because the thing I hate more than life itself practically right now is somebody coming up to me and go, I want to do the best I possibly can, best image quality I can. And I say, well, you probably don't know what you're talking about, do you? Because that very comment, I want to do the best I possibly can, like isn't the, that's not the sweet spot of the problem. The sweet spot of the problem is getting it done in a sensible amount of time and a sensible amount of budget. We have passed a point that you need to strive really, really hard to eke out the last bit of quality to get something that looks pretty good. You know, you're there. So the question is, for example, if I was transferring HD stuff, like proper full-on HD material at 4K and I was down-resing it, it's quite possible that I would transfer the actual stuff through Red Rushes and I wouldn't even have it on full debayer quality. Yeah, like I could actually have it at half and it would look almost identical to doing it at full and it would be dramatically faster. And for an HD production, I'd probably recommend that. And people would not normally do that if they didn't know what they were doing because they'd be like, oh my God, you can't not transfer all the settings up on max. And I'm like, well, kind of why not? Can you tell the difference? Okay. Now, that is not true for low light stuff where you're worried about noise.
The whole debayer thing, I might get you to, or we might jump back to sort of maybe cover that, and because it's still a concept I struggle with. But can I, so theoretically, if we're talking about what quality to work at, if we're saying theoretically you're finishing on standard F, NTSC, PAL, whatever, that theoretically start working on HD.
I think HD is a sensible level if you're going out. Like, it's a sensible level to do HD finishes, obviously.
Yep.
It's a sensible level to do standard def because you could argue reasonably that, you know, a few years down the track, you may want the footage at HD.
Yep.
That I have no problem with whatsoever. It's commercially viable. It's sensible. But, you know, people that say, I'd like to do it high res, if you were then to say to them, well, should we do it all at SR level? They go, actually, we're happy with HD cam. Well, HD cam is vastly worse than SR. I mean, it's like worse, like 10 generations, it starts to break up, there's compression, it's a whole lot of reasons, it doesn't have the grading latitude. But most people would say, away from Red, that SR, HD SR, is the gold standard for image quality. Well, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I'm talking about. Red at HD resolution is effectively very similar to HD cam SR. And most people would accept that as being totally gold standard for high quality. And that's what's coming out of the, you know, back of a Genesis. It's an HD SR tape.
So going back to the sort of the concept of oversampling, if we are all working at a slightly higher res than what you want to finish at, yeah?
Yep.
If we are wanting to output as HD, what sort of resolution should we be working at?
Well, you can shoot 4K, but you don't need to post it at it's like my example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like I would shoot on film and post it electronically for a final master. I gained a lot of benefits from shooting on film. I just didn't master it and work through it in post-production on film in my earlier analogy of what was going on. So in the same way, I would shoot it on 4K and I would happily work through it at 2K or HD in post and then deliver either a 2K HD finish or down-res it to a standard def. I can give you a lot of good economic reasons why HD is better than standard def, future-proofing, all that kind of stuff. But future-proofing at 4K is really hard yakka. Now, you have got the original camera neg at 4K when you store the R3D files, so that's really good.
Yeah.
But we're not talking like incrementally 10%. I'm talking like thousands of dollars left on the table, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars left on the table because you decided that you wanted to do a 4K run-through. Okay, so now working our way backwards from that, right? So then you say, well, how am I going to deal with this if I do want to use, say, a sensible workflow? I should also make one other point. As I said at the intro when we were discussing news and stuff, DI isn't the problem. A lot of DI manufacturers will say, oh, we can do 4K grading. And I'm like, okay, I don't have any problem with that. There's still no 4K distribution. The fact you can do 4K grading is great. But it isn't sensible to do a lot of 4K grading. It's just that they've made the gear now so that it can do 4K grading.
Sure.
And it's there. Just because it's there doesn't mean you have to use it.
Yeah, if they want to do it, they want to grade at that and then archive the whole job off on 4K, fabulous.
Oh, I am only going to want... It's just so slow, though, yeah. So yeah, let's say for a second that we've got a sensible workflow that's going to be either 2K or HD. For the rest of this discussion, I think that's where you're at. That's 99% of films, 99% of TV shows, episodic television, even commercials. I could argue that an HD finish is a sensible idea. But even if it isn't, it's not a bad place to be. Things run in real time. Monitors can display it. We have gear that understands it, you know, scopes that'll monitor it, all the other bits and pieces. Okay, so now we go, I want to do that. So now I want to work out how my workflow is going to be. Now, don't forget, I'm working backwards now. So I've already kicked the distribution box. It's 2K or HD. I'm now saying that I don't care what I'm grading at. It'll probably be 2K. I know the box can do larger, but that's not the critical step in the path. It's all of the offline editing, online editing, visual effects work, all of that stuff. I'm going to do that at 2K or HD. And now I need to make some decisions, and those decisions tend to be this. Firstly, is it going to be log or lin? In other words, is it going to be a logarithmic pipeline that you tend to use on feature films, or a linear pipeline, which actually isn't linear? It's what's called TV gamut. It's bent. It's just not that we have a good word for that, so we tend to use the word linear. But in reality, if you were to look at the video response curve of anything on video, it has a gamma, like say 2.2. It's a curve, it's a bent thing, it's not linear. But we needed a word that wasn't log, and the only word lying around that wasn't log was linear. So quite often people will say linear
Linear-ish.
Versus log, and what they simply mean is a classic Cineon DPX workflow or a linear one. And as I said in the past, but I'll say it quickly again, if you were in the old days sitting around in a post house and somebody said to you, I'm going to do the best quality I could, you would do a film finish electronically. And the film finish electronically would have a Cineon file, which was a 10-bit log file, and you would use that 10-bit log file. So we got into our heads that feature film level stuff was log, and video was linear, wasn't log, was the other thing, which we'll call linear, but we know it's actually got a video curve in there. Okay, so that's what we're used to, you know, just that's what we grew up with effectively. Unfortunately, when we hit red, 10-bit Cineon files aren't so special anymore, because just the fact that it's log doesn't actually make it miraculously better. A log file is just a way of saying, I'm going to bias this end of the, like, I have more detail on the blacks than the whites, basically. And that's all it does. But still 10-bit. Well, the camera is running 12 bits. And you might say, well, two more bits. Doesn't make much difference, does it? I mean, you know, what are you talking about here? A couple of bits seems pretty trivial.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not. It's an exponential kind of amount of data. If you go between 8-bit and 10-bit, you get a hell of a lot more data. If you go between 10 and 12, a ton more data. So, you know, you go up in stages, like you go like 128 steps of color. So let's say you had, for example, 256 steps of color, right? If you go up by just 2 bits, that turns into 1,024 stages of color. You take that up by another 2, you know, bits, and you're up to 4,000. So when you go up like those 2 bits, you didn't go from like 1,000 to 1,500. You went from 1,000 to 4,000. Like, it's four times better when you add those extra 2 bits. And so 12-bit is really, really good. Now, it happens to be that it's 12-bit linear out of the sensor. So you can, and I'm going to say these words really deliberately, you can down-res to Cineon files. So that's literally what you're doing. You're going from higher quality to lower quality and down-res to Cineon DPX files at 10-bit log, and that's your choice. But you didn't gain anything. You just actually lost something. Now, did you lose much? Well, no, as it so happens, 10-bit log files are a pretty good approximation to 12-bit linear, so nobody gets their knickers in a knot. But, you know, putting your hand on your heart, I can actually say mathematically there's less data in that classic Cineon file that the film guys are used to than we had in the 12-bit file. Okay, but that's now like me understanding stuff technically. All I'm trying to convey to you guys, the listening, is that if the camera's 12-bit, you don't gain anything. You do lose a little bit, but let's ignore that. You don't gain anything by going to log. The only reason that you would go to log is because everybody that wants to deal with these files is completely used to working in log, and we'd just like them that way, please. That's the only reason for doing it. There's no technical justification whatsoever. The only minor technical put you could put up is that the film recorders at the end of the whole pipeline expect DPX files, and so the more you can be what they expect, the better off you are.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to do a project. If somebody wants to do it logarithmic, it sure as hell ain't for image quality reasons. And that may actually be a surprise. Many people would be like quick to argue with that, but I'm telling you, it's a fact. You are not doing log files for quality reasons. You're just doing them because whoever is doing the effects is used to doing them that way. Now, I don't have any problem with that. Totally cool. Go for it. Knock yourselves out. But on The Knowing, for example, that Animal Logic did, they didn't use the DPX files they didn't take their R3Ds and turn them into 10-bit. They turned them into OpenEXR floating point files because they're a really good effects house. They know what they're doing. And they were like, well, I'm going to get everything we possibly can out of them. And that was a valid choice. Another valid choice would be to go to, say, 16-bit TIFF, which, as you know, is an option in, say, Red Alert. You can click the button for 16-bit TIFF. Now, again, if I go from 12-bit linear to 16-bit, do I suddenly get all this extra? Well, I do get extra theoretical adjustments, but you don't get anything better than what you put in. In other words, if I put in an image that's only 12 bits and I put it in a 16-bit container, there are a few bits lying around that aren't being used. It doesn't sort of miraculously give you hair detail or miraculously give you better highlights on a car. So that doesn't get me anything. But hey, yeah, it doesn't clip anything, doesn't cut anything off. Nothing wrong with doing that. Completely cool. Kind of bulky format, 16-bit TIFF, but there you go. So what I'm going to say is that I have these files. They are inherently 12-bit, and I have to make some decisions of what to do with them. And we know that the first thing that Red did was say, well, let's set up these proxies. Let's set up these proxy files, these QuickTime proxies that you can use, and then you could just edit those, and that'd be easy. And that is the simplest post pipeline. So people then say to me, aha, what are these proxy files? I hear they're only 8-bit. Well, unfortunately, that is where you really need to go to one more step of complexity than most people will happily show you, and to say that, you know what, guys, actually there is no inherent bit quality defined in the HD proxy. The HD proxies are not 8-bit. They directly reference that underlying 12-bit of data. And if you took it into some application, like a Final Cut-y kind of thing that reads QuickTimes, it will ask the QuickTime proxies for some data. And if it asks high enough, it'll get high enough stuff back. So you might say, oh, well, I took this QuickTime proxy into, you know, Bob's application and it banded. Well, that isn't a fault of the proxy. That's just a fault of Bob's application. Hmm. And so that's kind of annoying because you'd like to have a hard and fast rule, like QuickTime proxies are shit. You know, R3Ds are great, never use 3D, you know, but it doesn't work like that. And so the way that it actually works, just so you know, so we don't sort of hide anything from you, is that there is an underlying complexity of the way that the data is handled that even allows it to handle 32-bit over to an app. So if Final Cut or Compressor asked for it, they could actually get higher res than even 12-bit. Not that we gained any data there, you understand, like as before,
yeah.
But at least they're not in any way, shape, or form being clipped. Now, if you transcoded it, say, to, I don't know, Motion JPEG, right? Well, that's 8-bit. You just jumped down to 8-bit. You threw away information. You can no longer grade it as much. If you transcoded it to ProRes HQ, that's 10-bit.
Right.
So that's great. That's pretty good. If you transcoded it to, I don't know, TIFF, 16-bit, well, you're going to get all of it. You know what I mean? Like it's just the QuickTime itself is just a proxy. It's like this tiny little
a reference movie
accesses in. Yeah. So the proxy itself is not the deal. It's whether or not the proxy is dealt with in any way sensibly.
Yeah. Or what timeline you've dropped it into. Or
exactly.
Whatever.
And so you could easily take a proxy workflow and produce crap results, or you could take a great workflow and not produce crap results because you happen to know what's going on.
Right.
But that being said, they are proxy files and not the mega files themselves. So that gets you back to, well, I want to use the proxy files for maybe some of it.
So there is a limit, really, then.
There's a limit, yeah, because of stuff that happens. But it's pretty darn good depending on what the setup is. But obviously it's not 4K. It's not full access to the R3D files. You can't do stuff the way you can with the R3D files. And so there is a valid workflow that says, you know what, I just want to take my footage and I want to edit it and I want to finish editing it using the Final Cut proxies. And when I'm done, I'm just going to output it. Thanks very much. And there is some interesting stuff that can happen there that, you know, whether or not it's debayed and processed exactly the same and stuff. But most people's eye, that's going to be pretty good. But there is a sensible world of people that say, I'd like to know what my other options are. So this is pretty much what they are. You can do what's called an R3D matchback. So an R3D matchback says, I won't use the proxy that provided by Red. I will use that only for editing. And at some point later, I will go back and get myself R3D files. So a good example of that is DaVinci, you discussed at the top of the game. I might edit using the proxies, produce a list, go into DaVinci. Now it accesses the R3D files. I'm in a color grading environment, can do whatever I want. It may want to access the 4K file just because it wants to do a blow up. And that's completely valid. And that's a good reason for using R3D files, good reason for grading, all fine and dandy. A second thing you might say is, I don't like dealing with these proxies. They kind of freak me out a bit. But not only that, if I deal with the proxies, I need to keep the R3Ds attached to them. We've discussed this before. You can't take the R3D proxy and go and copy it to someone or email it to them, even though it's only 4K, because unless it's got the 2 gig file with it, it doesn't produce any images. So we had a problem on Dwarf where if you did the maths, you couldn't edit with the proxies because we'd have so much material that the offline editor would have to have, you know, terabytes of data sitting there just so the proxies would have the original R3Cs to refer back to.
Yeah.
In other words, his computer would not be doing much heavy lifting because it's just dealing with the little proxies. But as the little proxies need the R3Ds sitting in the same folder on his Mac that he was avid editing on, it would have to have terabytes of data with all those R3Ds. So it doesn't matter that it's a quick and easy way to work for a commercial. For a long form, just not viable for that offline editor to have all that data. So you say, okay, well, I want to take that proxy and turn it into something else. As I said a moment ago, dumb options would be Motion JPEG. Good options would be ProRes. And a ProRes is a much more stable option than working with proxy movies. So if I was to transcode from proxy to ProRes, like say ProRes HQ, that would be a great format upon which to keep working with, upon which to take into color to edit with. It would have a lot less problems in the send to color mode from Final Cut Pro. It's a great thing to do. You could color grade it, finish your job, and you finished at ProRes. And that's a great workflow because the files are smaller.
Absolutely. It's perfectly acceptable for broadcast.
The third option is that you completely... So we've now got, you've done the proxies, you've taken the proxies and turned them into something else like ProRes, and then just finished at ProRes, full stop. The third option is you say, well, you know what, I'm going to do a transcode, but not to a good HD quality like ProRes, which is expected to be finished on. I'm going to do it to a crappy quality, and I'm going to transcode it to a crappy quality. It's because I want to do your old-fashioned, good old, as I grew up with, offline process. So in that offline process, I just, you know, make a low-res copy and I use the low-res copy and I throw the low-res copy away and go back to what I started with. And that is completely valid. I mean, God, didn't we all grow up doing that? I mean, totally, right? So Avid, so Avid has, you know, DNX HD 3640 or DNX HD 115/120 or whatever it is that you want to go to, right up to DNX HD 175, 180. And in this model, I just transcode it to crappy quality and edit that. And when I'm done, I go back to my R3D files and conform those, which is pretty much the same method as doing the QuickTime editing, only this time around, I'm going back and not accessing based on QuickTime proxies and their master files, but actually a whole different set of files. The Avid doesn't need to have those master R3Ds anywhere near it. And that's what we're going to discuss in week three. In week three, we're going to discuss that problem, which is I would like to get my offline editor just to have a bunch of files. And by the way, this is what we did on Red Dwarf. He just edits them. He's totally happy, doesn't give a rat's about anything.
Yep.
And when he's done, and he does blow-ups and stuff in Avid, right? But they all look shocking because he's just blowing up the crappy low-res.
This tells you it's a doublehead. It tells you it's offline. And don't get picky.
And then we just go and conform. Okay, and then the last one of these options is to take something like a Scratch. This is the fourth option. Something like Scratch that can actually do manipulation of the R3D files and therefore, and it can edit. And there are other boxes coming out, maybe like a flame or a smoke. But yeah, stuff like that, where you just go, you know what? I've got a small amount of material. I'm just going to load this stuff up. It's going to access the R3Ds. I'm going to edit it direct and output it when done. And thanks for playing.
Because this is pretty much the workflow that's touted essentially for commercial production these days, is to, you've got money to spend, we will take all your files, make all life very easy for you, we'll be your new lab, give us your R3Ds, we'll put them through Scratch, and give you a Digibeta or SP or something to cut to, just like the old days.
Yep. And so those are our basic options. And now we just have to pick what we think sensible. And quite honestly, there are tricks in each of those categories. We've discussed in the past tricks when you go, you know what, I'd really like to use QuickTime proxies but be able to tweak them in Red Alert and then have that, you know, automatically fold back into... So we're going to discuss all of that in upcoming weeks, but this is just the basic stuff. And so we've decided now we don't need log. We've decided now how we're going to work. What we now have is the last bit, moving from the back to the front, which is, what does that mean on the darn camera? What do I have to do on the darn camera to get good results? And
good question.
Exactly. And so let me just explain what the camera does, and then next week I'm going to give you the what settings you want to set on the camera kind of stuff. But basically, this is what happens on the camera. You have a raw linear RGB image, and that image gets matrixed. It gets matrixed because, and I'm getting back to your early point about debayering,
I was trying to jump in there. Give me some specifics.
Yeah, that's
thinking,
right.
This is a big picture episode today.
But I'm working my way back. So I've got a chip. It's got R, G, R, G, R, G, R, G, and then...
The odd B in there.
B, G, B, G, B, G, B, G. In other words, what you've got is a sensor that has a Bayer pattern on it. It only samples each of the three colors less frequently than it does the luminance. This is something we've discussed. I think most people now know what a Bayer debayering pattern is. And the matrixing solves that. Matrixing also solves some stuff to do with the gamut of available colors that are coming off the camera. And that matrixing process is standard on any camera. I mean, any Genesis, whatever, has a matrix, even if it doesn't have a Bayer. So we've got that. Then we apply a LUT to it, and then we display it. That's what's happening on the camera. It's completely just exactly what happens on the camera. In software, the same thing happens. There's one extra stage called the DRX. But you get linear data of the camera. You apply DRX, which is a compensation for the highlight type stuff. You then matrix it, put a LUT on it, and display it. So those are the steps that are happening in the camera or in post. And the LUTs are always built on a linear light data. But the color space settings, the idea of am I in red space, am I in Rec 709, that is all just happening at the matrixing. It only affects the matrixing. And the gamma output settings are only in the LUT. So if I wanted to have something that was, say, in red space, but I wanted to output it logarithmically, the gamma stuff doesn't happen during the matrixing. So that's cool, right? I can apply something to get it in the right color space, but I haven't put in video gammas yet, which still gives me the option to go to log or video gammas or whatever else that I want at the end. Similarly, the way that it works in terms of stepping through the matrixing and the LUTs and stuff gives me a sense of being able to contain how much work is done to get a more pure image coming out the other end. So an example of that might be that I want to just have the color space set to the camera RGB and the gamma set to Rec 709. And if I did that, I would get a fairly neutral setting from the camera, especially if I had the ISO set to 320. So what I'm getting there is I'm not doing much in the way of matrixing, and I'm not providing much in the way of LUTs or lookup tables, but I have to do some of it because I have to get it in some kind of display mechanism. If I don't do that, the images that I see on the screen just look wrong, really wrong.
Yeah.
Now, the flexibility to take my RAW file and apply two stages to it, one which gets me a color space and one which gets me an output LUT, that causes a lot of confusion. And the reason is that the term Rec 709, for example, that exists. Like, you could have Rec 709A, which would be the matrixing, and Rec 709B, which is the LUT. Unfortunately, we don't. We have the one term, Rec 709, and I could mean that it's the Rec 709 color space, or I could mean it's the Rec 709 gamma setting. And if you've ever looked at Red Alert, this is what you're seeing at the top of screen.
Yeah.
The top of
now,
screen Red Alert.
This is probably, I've got to say, this is probably the number one, at least for my side of things, or people staring at it on set, or cameraman, DP, whatever, editors who are coming from the film side of things and the classic workflows. This is probably the first little trip. color space and gamma space.
And that's exactly why I've worked my way backwards. So if we know that we're not going out to film and we don't want to do log, then we don't need to worry about the gamma space putting us into log, of which there are three or four log settings,
right,
like red log, PD log 685 and 985. These log settings are gamma adjustments. They convert data because we're getting ready to go from 12-bit down to 10-bit log. And they kind of effectively compress the data, but they do it in such a way that it's pretty good. I don't want that if I'm working in video space, yeah?
Yep.
But even if I am working in film space, I could have the same, or video space, I could have the same desire to put it in a color space first. So there's two stages. I put in a color space and then I pick my gamma. If I'm going to an HD monitor, I'm going to want to put that in a color space of Rec 709, for example, right? And if I'm going to put that out to a film pipeline, as we discussed in the past, your best trick for somebody expecting film is to put out it in PD log 985 and drop the exposure 2 points. And that'll make it look the most like a standard Cineon scan file.
Right.
But you know what? If I was some kind of guy doing R&D, I might want linear light, or some guy that wanted to do something. Now, what confused people is that Red first introduced Redlog, which was their version of a good logarithmic file. They just said, oh, we can make a better solution than Cineon for, because we know all about these Red files. And, you know, Cineon was, let's face it, coming from film, and Red is, let's face it, coming from a sensor. So there's really no reason why a film-based log file would be a good format for, or a container to put Red files in. So Red innocently went, well, I got a better container called Redlog. And everyone went, whoa, wait a second, we don't know how to deal with that. And he went, well, okay, back off, don't use it. You know, if you don't want it, don't worry about it. We just thought we were helping out, but obviously I was wrong. Whatever, dude. You know, I'm just trying to be friendly. So that's all Redlog is. And then the next one that caused confusion was Red Space. And so just like we have with Rec 709, they made a red space for color space and they made a red space gamma curve for outputting. Now, again, you might have said, well, couldn't they have just called those two different things? But they were just trying to be consistent with Rec 709. Rec 709 has the same name for both, so they just tried to be consistent. So what is red space doing? Red space is putting the, in the first instance, it's the matrixing, it's the operation performed to put all the colors in the right place and debayer and stuff. And they have a better version, they think, a more interesting, more visually appealing set of colors that you can use, given the input data is coming from their Mysterium sensor. That's what the first one is. The second one is the gamma of what it looks like. That's, in other words, like how much curve you put in. Now, we've all played with gamma curves in Photoshop. We've all played with gamma curves in, well, most of us have played with them in Telecine and stuff. A gamma curve is just, you know, changing the midpoints and not really touching the whites and the blacks. So they were just saying, you know, if we bend this a little differently than a Rec 709, which was kind of designed, I've got to tell you, for tube cameras and then from there to CCD cameras, but not for CMOS cameras, we can produce just a nicer looking picture.
So Rec 709, it's like an industry LUT.
It's an industry LUT.
It's not, nothing to do with anything with Red in the front of it. It's the stuff that Red has
said. They said, we've got just a slightly better version of this. And so that's what you're getting at. And
but it's drastically different. I mean, I know part of the hang-up and part of the issue with, you know, that a couple of episodes ago, dealing with my issues, I always have, you know, doing a very small sort of in-house kind of, and I mean in-house, in home workflow was getting you know, the settings wrong in the color space and the LUTs here, really, these two little settings. And by putting it on red space, it looked half of the issues of it looking wrong and flat colors and things were you know, having color space set to red space, and you toggle it to 709, you go, whoa, hang on, that's what I was after. So there's,
well, see, it also relates to how you're monitoring it on set, but
yeah.
But I'm going to get into that stuff next week, because okay, this week was kind of the building.
Again, I'm
out
jumping
to
ahead.
Getting. No, it's fine. I'm just trying to say what I'm doing, right?
Yeah.
And next week, I'm also going to discuss the fact that what's metadata and what's not, and why have I got an ISO and an exposure, because aren't they the same thing in metadata? And
yeah.
And what I've only already touched on what DRX is, which is an adjustment for the clipping and the whites, but the white color, like the white balance, that's all happening in the matrixing, which is the color spacing, right? The LUT at the end, the gamma curves effectively that have been put on, or it could be a LUT if it's, you know, a film thing. That's a lookup table that's applied once we've picked a space. It's completely valid, actually, to have a midpoint where you say, I want this in red space. I want you to use the colors that the sensor guys at Red think are good sets of colors. And then from here, I can go to video or I can go to film. And that's why it's a two-stage process.
And we should also, as part of that, look at, obviously, the settings on the camera as well, because there are some definite gotchas as to, you know,
raw
what
on the
format
camera
or what format you shoot at, 16 by 9, 2 to 1, all that sort of stuff can limit your abilities in workflows.
But obviously, all of this is just best understood from the metaphor that we have got of digital SLRs. And digital SLRs, take raw files and we grade them. Now, the difference with digital SLRs and where this is really informative is there is no standard, if you think about it, for printing your digital SLR photos out to the printer. Do you know what I mean? Like, that is completely like, nobody says, oh, I've got my printer set up in standard settings, so what I see on my screen is what I come out of the printer.
It's all done by the printer software that
you install. Or black art, or just trial and error. Okay.
Yes, exactly, trial and error.
But if the print world had got its shit together and actually produced a standard for getting the prints to come out of the printer looking the same, that's what they would have in Photoshop Bridge. They would have two settings, one which is the conversion from RAW, and one is the, quote, LUT gamma space of going out to your RAW printer.
Yeah.
But the reason that print only has one stage is they never solved the second problem. But the TV guys always did. The film guys always did. The film guys didn't care what it looked like on your monitor. They only cared what it looked like on a release print or on a TV in your home. And so they had this huge amount of standardization, which is gamma space or output LUTs. And the print guys don't. So the print guys just have the one stage of, I need to work out how to get this from Canon RAW format into my computer so I can deal with it in Photoshop. And we have two. We have, I need to work out how to get it into something that I can look at, and, oh, by the way, some kind of gamma curve for looking at it when we go out to film or out to video or whatever.
Yes,
and quite frankly, I kind of wish that the print world had got its act together, because it'd be nice if you could say that printer is Rec 709 standard and all my stills will come out looking consistent.
Man, the amount of settings in your printer, you know.
Could you imagine if I could say to you, your printer at home will look exactly the same as my printer here because they're God printers.
Yeah.
But that's what we say in video. We say your image over at, you know, a really good post house like Bean,
that's
right. Rec 709 looks identical to what it does at my God monitor here. Usually. Because they're all in the same standard.
Yeah. Yes. In an ideal world, once you finish grading and staring at the monitor, you don't go back to your online suite and start putting supers and graphics on it and going, hang on, this grade looks completely different.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
But you do. Bloody hell, I've done that with prints. I'll print stuff out for my digital stills camera, my 5D really good stills camera, and different printers will make it look vastly different.
Change the paper and it'll look completely different.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so definitely, yes, I can. It's a great analogy.
Okay, so that's what we're going to be dealing with next week. The week after that, as I said, we're going to do all the offline stuff. We're going to discuss next week, you know, things like red rushes and how to deal with red cine and red alert and a bit more on that. The week after that, we'll do Final Cut, and then last week we'll handle stuff that has native R3D support. And we will, as I say, try and give you as clear a tactile, press this button to get what you want, kind of our guide to what's going on. But you know what? Feel free to email me if you think it's not clear. And if you'd like a hell of a lot more information and pretty pictures, there are whole courses at FXPhD.
Too right. Well done.
That's it.
All right.
One over. I hope that's all right. You guys still listening? I hope you are.
Hello.
You have asked for this. It's not like I hope it's all right. Give me feedback. Twitter me if you hate it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, admittedly, obviously, that is really just a real big overview, and the next few apps will start to get, as you say, click this button kind of specifics. So
I'm not going to go back and re-explain some of this stuff. When we're discussing Avid workflow, I'm going to be like,
okay,
just be able to discuss.
But I will
that.
Be pushed. I'll be making sure that it is, you know, click this button, flick this switch. Kind of, this is what we. This
totally.
Is, this is
I'm
kind
there,
of.
Man.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's all about cutting through the shit, and so people don't have to do wade through manuals. Some quick and easy guides when you're pulling this camera out of the box,
I will give you the exact
or your
bin, steps that
or
we
the
did
director or the PA hands you that drive of R3Ds. You know, you're gonna know what to be able to do.
I've got to tell you the two things I hate the most. Well, firstly, quite frankly, I love the fact that on Red Dwarf it worked. We put together a plan. It worked. It went really well.
You didn't have time for it to not work.
We did not have time for it not to work. The second thing I really hate is I get a phone call from somebody and they say, I have these DPX files that somebody's transferred from a Red camera and they don't seem right. What should I do to fix them? So how do they transfer? I have no idea.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, so that is the biggest error in history, to just say I have some DPX files, which already it's like, why are you in log? But then they go, and they don't look right. I don't want to talk to you.
It can happen. People do make these mistakes.
So anyway, yeah, said. Okay.
Okay, so we're going to end off today with a sort of a Red Room stroke interview with stroke a gear roundup with a new piece of gear that came out, which is something that underwater guys have been clamoring for a long time. A really good, totally custom built, designed for the Red One underwater housing. So Gates Housings, who are like kings of this world, have made something called the Deep Red, which is beautifully made, custom built, designed from the ground up for the Red One, with all the menu control and ports and things, everything that you'd need. You can use your existing camera, use existing bricks, existing drives, existing monitors. So it's a fantastic piece of kit. And I had the chance to speak to John Ellerbrock a week or so ago, who's the CEO of Gates Housings, and here's what he had to say. Okay, today I'm speaking to John Ellerbrock, president of Gates Housings and designer of their new Deep Red underwater housing. Hey, John, thanks for taking the time.
No problem, Jason. Good talk to you.
Well, look, I might just start with a quick little backstory of Gates Housings. You guys have been around for a while and a real icon in the industry.
Well, yeah, I guess you could say that. We work pretty hard to maintain a quality product out there. We're celebrating 40 years now. And the founder of the company, Elwin Gates, began in 1969 making macro framers for Nikonos cameras. You might remember way back when the Nikonos 1, 2, 3, ultimately up to the 5, he took a unique idea to be able to shoot macro subjects and created a product to do so using a 50mm lens on a Nikonos camera. And from that, he began to expand into other things that included cables and accessory items, and ultimately in the 80s began making entire housings for still cameras and video cameras, and did them mostly on a custom basis, and then in the 90s began to do them on a more production level, getting into some of the high 8 cameras and ultimately the DV, and now we're into high definition. And that's the short story of the last 40 years, but all through that, if there were common threads, it was a commitment to a quality product and customer service.
Well, we'll dig a little deeper into the Deep Red shortly, but for those land lovers like me, can you just step back a little bit and explain why a housing just can't be a square box with a lid and a bit of Perspex out the front of it?
Well, it could be, actually. There are designs out there for other manufacturers where you can have a basic box with a flat piece of glass in front of it or plastic, acrylic. But when you do that, you give up a whole lot of things. There's a lot of compromises when you do that. You can't have controls where you like them. You can't have the precision control of camera functions that you'd like to have. And it makes it very difficult to use dedicated ports that can, in some cases, give you very, very good performance that, lenses that are uniquely designed for underwater to give you a very wide angle field of view, and in some cases, maintain your zoom-through capability for shooting macro. So the Gates approach has always been to design a shell for a specific camera to give you maximum control, maximum capability, the use of best optics in front of it, and give you a product that's going to give you the most capability underwater. When you start to get away from that, you just lose a lot, and that just wouldn't describe a Gates then.
So take us through the theory of the port, what it is and why it's really important, because it seems to be almost more important than the housing itself.
The ports are, as you say, very important underwater for several reasons. One, you've got to remember underwater, you've got to put something between the camera and the water to keep everything watertight. So no matter what you put there, it's affecting the optical chain, and it's affecting what the camera is capable of doing. Historically, using a simple dome or a flat piece of glass was the only thing available, and people, underwater photographers or videographers got by with that because it was all that was available. As time progressed, we began to get into the ability to use adaptive optics, which meant, like on land, you have multiple glass elements encased in a shell to widen your field of view or give you the ability to shoot very small subjects. And it has evolved over time to where we can provide ports now with extreme performance. For example, we sell a super wide port for some of our products that give you up to 110 degree field of view and retain the zoom through capability that gives you macro subjects all in one lens. And it truly is nearly all in one lens. You would only need to complement that with perhaps a high macro setup, which would include maybe an Achromat diopter behind a flat element to give you very, very tiny critters. But, that super wide pretty much covers the whole gamut. And if you want to get good edge-to-edge image quality with virtually no distortions, no compromises to your image quality, then you definitely need to have something that was designed for a camera and for underwater. If you don't do that, you're going to get those compromises, and things are not going to be as good as they could be.
So is it actually performing an image correction sort of role, I guess, the port itself, or is it just simply a domed area to let the lens go forward past the housing and then obviously and thus get you the wide view?
Well, the super wide port is actually neither. It's neither a dome nor is it a lens that's behind a dome. It is a completely encased set of glass elements in its own shell that bayonets onto the housing that is, number one, designed for a specific camera. So, for example, we have a super wide 44 that's designed specifically for the Sony EX1. And you, much like a prescription eyeglass would be, if you were to have eyeglasses for you, say, Jason, if you were to give them to a friend of yours who had a different prescription or didn't wear glasses, they would not be able to use them. They wouldn't be able to focus or something would be wrong. And that analogy works for underwater. For a lens that's designed for the Sony EX1, it would very unlikely work with anything else, like, say, a Panasonic, for example. So it's very important that such optics are matched up with the cameras that they're designed for.
Okay. Well, take us through the Deep Red housing now. And I guess for people who have come from other housings and other cameras, what's going to really appeal to Red owners now with this new housing?
Well, besides being a Gage product, which is dedicated to being a bulletproof, highly reliable design, which means aluminum shell, stainless mechanical controls, and 450-foot depth rating. The Deep Red is far and away the most precision product we've ever made. And sophisticated isn't the right word, but it has a lot of features in it that you don't find in our other products, largely because it's aimed at a cinema camera. As you know, Red is designed as a digital cinema camera, so it is more like a film camera than it is a video camera. So in that regard, our design had to go after different feature sets. We were able to access all the functions on the camera, including a very difficult joystick control on the rear, but also any lens that you want to put on it. You have access to iris focus, and if the lens supports it, zoom, without the controls ever changing position on the housing. And that's a big deal because as a user, regardless of the lens you put on it, your control locations never change. And again, they're all mechanically interfaced with the exception of the zoom control. That is a motor control to give you smooth zooming should you need it. The other features of the housing include a very compact design. If you look online, we've got a number of photos there that show the battery and the recording drive are mounted on top of the camera to minimize the overall size, minimize the length of it, and give you a very, very usable, functional design.
Yes, it's not just the housing, is it really? That's quite a complicated bracket there on the top to mount the drive and the battery on top of the Red one and let it all slide in as one unit into the housing.
That's exactly correct. And it's hard to describe without showing it to you firsthand, but the design actually, the camera does not slide into the housing, but rather the shell itself slides away from the camera to the rear. So you've got, once you pull the shell off, you've now got the camera on the tray and the front bulkhead and the whole lens front area all exposed so that you can not only mount the camera easily and readily, but it's now exposed for you to do anything to it that you need to. So, for example, changing the battery, changing the drive are straightforward and immediate. You don't need to remove the camera or do anything magic. You just change them out, put the rear shell back on, you're ready to go back in the water.
So just talk about external controls. Obviously, Red One's pretty complex beast,
uh-huh.
A little bit more complicated than the average film camera.
Right.
What level of control does the operator have when the Red One's in the housing?
Well, you've got the controls I've already mentioned, focus, zoom, and iris.
Yep.
To go with any lens you're going to put on it. On the Red camera in particular, you've got an assignable control, which from the factory allows you to set white balance. And despite it recording in RAW format, you still activate white balance, so you have some reference underwater to see the colors that you're getting. So you've got that, you've got expanded focus. On the rear of the control, you've got the joystick. You've got full access to the system, menu, your shutter speed, your ISO, your frame rate, many things that you, depending on the shooting situation, you may want to change underwater. Most likely, it's been in our survey, we find that most users are going to set these before they go in the water.
Yeah.
But if they find they need to set, say, a shutter speed for faster action, or they need to boost up their ISO because their light is fading for the day, they've got access to all those underwater. So it's really powerful thing to get at. And of course, you know, record, standby, and I should also mention there is a tally light on board, which is a very cinematic thing. If you've got a subject in front of you that needs to know that the camera's rolling, as it were, they've got that. So you've got a lot of features built in to not only access those controls, but things that are aimed at the cinematic market.
Fantastic. Now, there's an external monitor, obviously, on board for this.
That's correct.
I believe you use your existing Red monitor?
That's correct, the Red 5.6 LCD.
Okay, so obviously all the connections are within that housing. Then you've got your own proprietary cables from the housing to the monitor housing.
That's correct.
Okay, excellent.
Well, the interface to the Red is the same interface you would use if they were interconnected outside the housing. So all we did really was find a way to pass those signals through a bulkhead connector.
Now, I've occasionally used underwater housings and probably been more the person topside than underneath. But what fascinates me is how you guys get video out of these things. Take us through how that works, split up to the dry land.
Well, the surface feed is actually comes straight out of there's an HDSDI output of the camera. And on two other housings we've already done, we have found a way to pass that signal through a bulkhead connector and then feed it. So far we've done up to over 300 feet of cable to the surface. So you then at the surface, if your director of photography wants to see what's going on below, they've got their own high definition feed to do so.
Fantastic. 300 feet of SDI, high definition, right up to the surface. Fantastic.
Right.
Is there like a standard port that this comes with? Well, you talked about a macro port and a wide angle port.
Well, for Red it's a little different. Because there's so many different lenses that people want to use, we're planning to offer a simple flat port and a dome port, and high-quality ones at that. Unlike some of our other video housings where we can make an adaptive optic like a wide-angle adapter or a wide-angle converter, we can't do that with Red unless we pick one single lens and go after it. And despite having a lot of cameras out there, we don't see the market supporting that type of a thing. The volumes just aren't there for us to go do that. So, and it's not clear that it's necessary because with such a wide variety of lenses available, shooting them behind a dome or behind a flat element is going to work in 90%+ of the situations that people want to shoot. Now, at the moment, we do not have any lenses on our radar screen that we cannot support. So everything customers have asked for, there's nothing barring the way for us to support them. And that includes all Cook Primes, Anjanou, specifically the 15-40, all Zeiss lenses, Ultra Primes, Master Primes, the Aeroflex 8R, which is very popular out there for shooting wide. And as you know, underwater, wide and close for those wide shots is oh so important. So there's nothing out there that we can't support right now in terms of lenses.
And as you mentioned, the port itself has to be really high quality. You're talking essentially something that could be used up to IMAX projection, really.
Correct. So we have a couple of different options for the dome. We've got a basic acrylic, and we offer an acrylic and a glass version, as we do with all of our housings, because the some customers want to use acrylic because the index of refraction is so close to water, and in the field they can buff it out if they need to, and they're are partial to that. Some are partial to glass. They believe that it's more optically pure. And in the case of red, our dome is going to be anti-reflective coated on both sides. It's going to be specially tempered so it can go to the depths that we want to rate it to, up to 450 feet. So, and it's going to be optically, very optically pure glass. So we've got a really good glass dome that is expected in my hands any week now. Or any day now, so we can start getting that out to the field as well.
Fantastic.
And as you point out, you know, when you're shooting 4K, having something really good in front of the camera is very, very important.
How do you filter this stuff inside a dome? Do the cinema guys do it, or is that just a stills thing?
The location of the lens with respect to the dome changes with the lens, and part of our design is such that we know exactly from working with the lens manufacturers, we know the ideal location to put a dome with respect to each lens. The design includes what we call a port extender, which changes length depending on the lens. So that's number one. Number two, to your point, with the red, because it's recording in RAW, you don't necessarily need to change anything up front with a filter, and I say that with certain reservations. Because once you've got your raw data in there, you'll go in later and say, I want to do my white balance now in post, which is exactly the workflow that's going to happen, whether you're above water or below. Now, in the case of when you're below water, because you do lose so many of the reds and the yellows, there are instances where you may want to put a filter on. With the red, you're going to have to affix them somehow to the lens. And the people that are shooting out there have not said, hey, we need to put a filter on here. With the red housing, there's no flip-in filter. There's no way to do it unless you put it on the front of the lens.
Okay.
So that's going to have to be that's the paradigm right now.
Right. So the general workflow with any camera that has a white balance of ability is correct all of the color by doing white balance or correcting it later in RAW rather than putting any filter on, which would be the old way of doing things with film, I guess, with stills and with cinema.
Yeah. Well, if you remember back to the days of film, they, you know, you pick a particular film type, say, you know, in the photographic world, there might be a Velvia. But you pick a particular film type to shoot underwater, and you wouldn't put a filter in front of the lens. It would just be matched up to what you were shooting. In the RAW format, it's hard to make parallels there. But when you do get in post, you can make those color corrections to get the accurate colors that you want underwater.
So when are you expecting to get that rolling out production models?
Right now, sometime mid to late April.
Okay, fantastic. So how can people contact you, order them, find out more, see some of these pictures?
Oh, they can visit us on our website, which is gateshousings.com. And from there, they can get in touch with us directly or find any of our dealers around the world and get in the queue, which is quite long now. We've got a number of customers waiting for them, and so I'd encourage anyone out there that's thinking about it to get in touch and get in the queue.
So if you join the queue now, when would be your expected delivery date?
The first ones are going to start rolling off in that late April time frame, and our expectation is we'll be getting out about 2 a week, I think. So that'll take us well into May and to June to be delivering all of the housings we've got on order.
That's nothing. They're used to much longer wait times than that, don't you worry.
Yeah, well, we've taken longer on this design than we expected. We're not holding anything back on that, but and there's a number of reasons for that. A lot of it has to do with the fact that so many new features went into this that are unlike what we've done in our previous designs, that we wanted to make sure it was right and that it was that home run that I was describing. The good news is that when future products from Red come around, the Epic and the Scarlet, so much of what we've done here will leverage forward into that, and the design time will be far less for those cameras, and we'll have in place, you know, great optical domes, good optical elements to put in front of it, all the gearing designs that we've done to accommodate different lenses. So much of the work we've done will carry forward, and it'll be not nearly the weight and It'll be good. It'll be a lot of stuff carried forward.
Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing some imagery from your customers. It'll be fantastic. 4K underwater, down to 450 feet or whatever it is. Can't wait.
Yeah, neither can I.
Well, look, thanks, John. Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jason. It's good to talk to you, and thanks for putting this all together.
Thanks for that, Jason. Actually, it's pretty interesting that you did that, because we've been actually working with someone locally who's been making their own housing for the Red. They've been borrowing our Red to test it.
Wow.
And I'm actually really keen to do underwater photography with the Red. It's the one area we've not done any of yet, I think.
Yeah, look, I mean, because I know personally who have done some simple stuff, and I know people who have done some stills work and have had incredible problems with, just the general housings, finding something to fit their camera in, and also the whole colour balance thing. So that which obviously John covered there, saying that really you don't need to do anything. There's no filters, no nothing. You just go ahead, just white balance it.
We went to down south to a big shoot, huge shoot, 5 days kind of shoot. First shot, first day, underwater in the pool. Water leaked into the 35mm, one of the 35mm cameras. Oh, my Lord. It's an ugly thing.
Gorgeous. Yeah, look, you know, even the best housings, you'll still rip them apart just to put, change the film when you go, oh, okay, give me a towel. So, yeah, no, I'm sure things have moved on a bit since then.
The interesting thing for me is, I assume that heating isn't a problem, because I always assumed that it's in cold water, right? So.
Right, I see. Overheating inside enclosed box.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. Yeah, I didn't sort of think about that.
But anyway, I think that underwater photography with Red is going to be just awesome. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess you're surrounded by very cold stuff, and the box you're in is super cooled from the outside. So
I think, yes.
It couldn't possibly overheat.
Not like there's a lot of extra airflow, though, is there?
What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong?
It's only a computer with a lens on it underwater.
Hey, where can people find you in the internets? Because we're running a bit over. This is a long, very long.
My website, jasonwingrove.com. It's got the reel and contact details and all that sort of rubbish. Twitter, Wingrove.
And I'm Mike Seymour. And, of course, all the information with the courses for FX PhD are over at fxphd.com.
And I'm also occasionally on VFX Show. And I think the next step we're going to deal with The Abyss, an awesome film, which I'm dying to speak about, crap on about, and pretend I actually know anything about it.
We like The Abyss. But which version?
Which version? Ah, that's tricky, because, I've got the slightly later version, the director's version, I guess you'd call it.
Mr. Cameron. All right, thanks so much for listening, guys. Please give us feedback, because if you don't like the direction we're going in with this month, then tell us. If you do like it,
too right.
Tell us that as well. We really appreciate your time. Talk to you guys later.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.